recent news has shown that a spot at an elite college campus can be bought with fabricated credentials and bribery, apparently. The author of a new book says no matter who gets in and how they get there, what happens after students get to campus is also important. That's the focus of his new book, examining the experiences of students coming from lower-income backgrounds when they find themselves surrounded by wealthy classmates on an elite campus. Anthony Abraham Jack is a junior fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows and an assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He holds the Schutzer Assistant Professorship at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, and his new book is called The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. Tony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to spend most of our time on your book, Tony, but I did want to get your reaction to these indictments. A lot of people, dozens and dozens of people indicted for bribery schemes, test cheating, things like that, to get into some of these same elite schools you're looking at.
Yes, I mean, it goes back to an old saying, what happens in the dark eventually comes out to the light. And that's kind of one of the things that I think about when I reflect on this situation. It's remarkable just the steps that parents took to hoard even more resources for their children to break the law. I see this as part of a larger system, a larger culture of people just assuming, amassing as many resources as possible for their kids and even taking extra steps to exclude other people from that, from the places where they live to the schools that they attend, to paying $200 to $500 an hour for tutors, for essay writers, or writing the essays for their kids themselves. I mean, this is part of a larger system of class reproduction. These people got their hands caught in the cookie jar.
Now let's turn to your book, and you focus on the opposite end of the economic spectrum from the people who are buying their way into colleges, people from low-income backgrounds getting into elite institutions. What led you to want to study this group?
So two things. This is also my story. When I entered college, I was a first-generation college student. I went to Amherst College in 2003, and at the time, Amherst was 1.5 times my mother's annual income. So 1 year at Amherst was 1.5 times what my mother was making in a year. And when I got to campus, I asked myself a question: where are the other poor Black people? And the reason why I asked that question is because so many of my other classmates were talking about riding on private jets, going on island vacations, studying abroad in high school. I thought I was the only poor Black person on a rich college campus. And it turned out when I got to graduate school and was reading all the sociology and economic research, they also did not make talked about low-income students in one way and rich students in another, when really a lot of my peers had gone to preparatory high schools and boarding schools like Andover and Exeter and St. Paul. And so I didn't see my classmates in the literature, but I also knew this story firsthand, given that I lived part of it myself. And so I wanted to investigate, what does it mean to be a poor student on a rich college campus, and show that 1/2 of the lower income students at elite schools, Black, actually graduated from boarding day and preparatory high school, which cuts across the grain. That's not what you imagine when you think about a low income first generation college student who's Black. You don't think boarding school, but really that's where they tend to graduate from.
Let's talk about that group now, the privileged poor, you call them in your book and the title of your book. Who are they? How do they end up in these elite preparatory schools before going to an elite school like, say, Harvard?
Yeah, that's a great question. The privileged poor are lower income students who graduate for boarding day and preparatory high schools. They're economically disadvantaged, but they have access to the academic and social experiences of the top 1%, right? They study abroad in high school. They are taught by PhDs. And oftentimes what I found is that students get in through three ways, through programs like Prep for Prep and A Better Chance, programs that actually work to place lower income students into private high schools, direct scholarship programs at the individual high school. So high schools like colleges have initiatives to diversify their campuses. And that's one way. And then the third way is sure by happenstance, that someone who like as a janitor, a person who works in a bank, one of the bankers says, hey, my son or daughter goes to this school. They have a scholarship program. You should look into it because it's a really good school.
Talking to Anthony Abraham Jack about his new book, The Privileged Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. And Tony, you look at two groups in the elite school. You look at the privileged poor, you were just talking about. They had some of this preparation in a preparatory school. They learned some of the rules of how to be in an elite college.
Yes.
And then low-income students who didn't have that training, that they came out of maybe a public high school, and this is an alien world. Compare and contrast for us.
Yes, I call those students the doubly disadvantaged because they're economically poor, yes, but where they're truly disadvantaged is they typically go to distressed, under-resourced, overcrowded public high schools, especially given that I study lower-income Black, Latino, and white undergraduates. Especially for my lower-income Black and Latino undergraduates, their high schools are very much more disordered and under-resourced compared to their peers. And so they have classrooms that teachers spend more time managing disorder than teaching lessons or making connections with students. And so when they come to college, everything around them is foreign to them. And the example that I use to highlight is the term office hours is thrown around campus as much as extension party, a party is, right? But professors don't really, they always say when office hours are, they never say what office hours are. And so many lower income students who come from public schools, i.e. the W disadvantage, encounter a new language, encounter a new world, a new set of rituals that they must then navigate, like with their peers, but they have never encountered this thing before. And so what I try to do is I show how social class shapes how both groups move through campus, but show that it's not just that lower income students find it hard to get into this place. It's specifically lower income students who come from disadvantaged communities, because that removes the conversation from individual differences to societal defects, right? This is about the disinvestment in K-12 education. It's oftentimes about neighborhood inequality and all of the things that keep lower income students in more disadvantaged positions.
And let's take a step back before we return to the story of those students about why it might matter who is going to elite institutions and the connections they make there. A lot of people in Wisconsin might think, well, I'm not going there. I'm not going to send my kid there. But for example, I was looking of our 9 Supreme Court justices. All of them had some Harvard or Yale education. Harvard, Yale, and Columbia have an overwhelming preponderance of Supreme Court justices. Just one example.
Absolutely. The thing is, connections do matter. And who you sit next to in class can definitely influence your mobility prospect. But more generally, let's take a step back. Elite colleges serve as mobility springboards for disadvantaged groups. If you are a lower income student, if you are from a non-traditional background, going to an elite school or the most selective school of all the ones you are admitted to, you have a higher chance of moving up the economic ladder than where you started from. Right. And that has amazing, amazing effect on people's life chances going forward. But like you said, connections do matter. Who you sit next to, the kind of opportunities that are available to you, and also the resources at the school. I mean, these schools are able to invest in mental health services, career services, study abroad opportunities in ways that less resourced schools cannot. And all of those things matter for the kind of accumulation of cultural and social capital that students really need in college for college to truly be as big of a springboard as we want it to be.
One other concern you saw for those doubly disadvantaged students, it wasn't just that they didn't know the norms, the rules of what to do at an elite college. There were economic issues, something as simple as, hey, we're closing the cafeteria during break.
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's where both the privileged poor and the doubly disadvantaged face hurdles, right? So they're both still economically disadvantaged. They don't have money. And what I discovered is that at the time of my study, only 1 in 5 schools that have adopted progressive no-loan financial aid policies actually kept their dining halls open during spring break. And some people may say, well, don't they go home? A lot of lower income students cannot afford to go home. And disproportionately, some students also don't have a home to go to, because a number of the students who I interviewed, both among the privileged poor and the doubly disadvantaged, were homeless during college or even in the foster care system. So they didn't really have a home to go back to. And that brings about food insecurity. Like, these students had to go 10 days not knowing where their next meal is coming from. And so there's some real obstacles that social, again, like looking at how money matters in college goes beyond how much financial aid you get or how much you pay. Like, there's some real consequences for what happens in between complication and commencement about how money shapes how you move through college.
We're talking to Anthony Abraham Jack from the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His new book is called The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you went to college, especially if you were a first-generation college student in your family, did you experience anything like a culture shock when you get there? Did you feel comfortable going to, say, office hours or consulting advisors for help? How'd your background influence your college experience? Or if you're on the other side of things, if you work at a college or university, what is out there for lower-income students at your institution? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Anthony Abraham Jack from the Harvard Graduate School of Education. We're talking about his new book, The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you grew up in a lower income household, went to attend college, did you feel different than your peers? How about if you were a member of a minority group in a mostly white campus? Are you a first generation college student? What was the experience like, especially those first weeks and months at school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Cole is with us in Milwaukee. Cole, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question for the guest about intersectionality. So with students that are from low-income backgrounds that are white, their experience can be very different, especially like you were talking about with these primarily white institutions, than students from low-income backgrounds that are black too. So I was just wondering what the guest had to say about intersectionality specifically on campus.
Tony?
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. I actually did interview black, white, and Latino undergraduates to focus in on especially lower income students to see how race shaped the experiences of those who come from similar class backgrounds. And one thing that I did find is that oftentimes people made assumptions that all white students on this campus were rich. And so the white students had to deal with being outed at times, like around spring break, around the jobs that they had. They had to navigate relationships of people discovering their class background after making assumptions about it. And that often led to very, very awkward situations. Rather, the flip side was true with the black and Latino students. The stereotypes that we have of black and Latino students is that they are all poor. So a lot of the interactions cemented that thought that black and Latino students were poor on campus. So instead of being outed, they felt that they were confirming stereotypes with some of the jobs that they had, some of the ways in which their experience was different from their white peers. But I purposely wanted to interview both white, black, and Latinx students so as to talk about the racialized experience of class on a college campus.
That reminds me, thanks for that call, Cole, of a moment, a low-income, I think a Latinx student from the L.A. area was at an elite school, found out, there's a student from Mexico here, great, we can connect. But it turned out that student was very wealthy, got flown to Dallas Cowboy games whenever he wanted, and there was a different kind of class gap there.
Yes, a lot of students actually had to come to terms with being around students from wealthy background, a lot of the low-income students are being bound wealthy people for the first time of their same race. Because if you look at patterns of segregation in this country, it's not just that whites and blacks don't live next to each other. It's like the income segregation in this country is growing greater and greater. So a lot of students, like the student who encountered a wealthy Mexican student for the first time, he was like, there was no connections. Like, he said, I thought I found my people, right? He felt like that was the one symbol of home, the one piece of home that he had, and he had absolutely no connection with this person because this person was talking about being flown with his father to Dallas Cowboy games every home game.
Let's bring on another caller now. Cynthia is with us in Menominee. Hello, Cynthia.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about?
I was especially prompted to call by the comment about foster children, students who have aged out of the foster system. That's huge. They don't get support, but Stout, UW-Stout, has a fostering success, I believe it's called, where they actually reach out to students who have been in foster homes who are coming with no family support, and they're working with those students to get them connected on campus, to get helping them get the supplies that they need, helping them during school breaks so they have a place to go or they can stay in the residence hall. And it's one thing to offer an opportunity, but if you don't have a connection that can help you be successful, Student Support Services on the UW Eau Claire campus, which is where I worked my last 9 years at the university, we worked really hard to get them connected to campus, to open them to experiences outside of campus, helping them. We would actually travel up to the cities. Many hadn't been into a larger city.
Cynthia, I'm going to jump in and bring our guest in on this now. Tony, she's saying, I think this is a lot about what you're talking about. It's one thing to open the door and get low-income students onto campus, but yes. What do you do once they're there, as she says, to build those connections?
Absolutely. As I say in the book, access is one thing, inclusion is another. And we have focused oftentimes too much on who gets in that we fail to give significant attention to what their experience like once they get on campus. And she is absolutely right, because to understand the student experience and why they adopt certain strategies for navigating college once they get in campus, we have to understand not only where they come from, but what they have been through to get to college. We need to be as prepared to help our students from more rural backgrounds as we are from center cities. We need to make sure that we are prepared to help students who are in the foster care, who are in or aged out of the foster care system, depending on when they enter college, as well as we are those who come from, who are the children of alumni. We have to understand the diversity among the lower income students in front of us, so that we are better prepared to serve them and better have a better inclusive campus.
Cynthia, thanks for sharing your experiences. We're talking to Anthony Abraham Jack about his new book, The Privileged Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. Back to another caller now. Dorotea in Madison is with us. Dorotea, hi.
Hello.
What did you want
thanks
to tell us about, Dorotea?
I wanted to share some of my experiences. I'm a first-generation college graduate and also an international. I was an international student. I'm originally from Bulgaria. And I wanted to share one of the aspects of how the system doesn't work for some of us. In my university, it was required to have meal plans for the first 2 years of studies. And they were actually pretty expensive. They were kind of like market prices almost like going to a restaurant, maybe not as high, but you could probably prepare some of those meals a lot cheaper at home. And I was also employed by the university at the food services there, so I could get free meals, but I actually still had to pay a meal plan that was quite expensive, and I couldn't really afford, even though I could get free meals or prepare them myself at home. So that was one of the aspects. And the other one that resonated with me was your host mentioned how universities are often closed during some of the breaks, like, Thanksgiving break, spring break, winter break. And a lot of us can't afford the extra expense to pay extra to stay on campus.
Dorotea, I'm going to jump in because we don't have too much time left, but that really that reinforces, Tony, what you were talking about. Some of those hidden costs is not just the tuition costs.
No, it's not. It is these added costs that are literally sometimes built into the schedule. Given like the spring break, Thanksgiving break, people assume that all students can afford to go home or for fun in the sun. But the other piece is like we're talking about lower income college students, but look at how even that example of the closings of the dining halls and the expense of the dining halls also hurts international students who may not be able to afford to go that far in such a short amount of time, right? So the way in which like being more inclusive is not just about catering to lower income students or changing your standards because of them. It's about making the campus better for all students so they can succeed.
And Tony, briefly, as we wrap up, one of the solutions you point to, and you alluded to this earlier, is getting students the experience, more students, the knowledge, the skills, the cultural capital they need to thrive on these campuses, not just students who go to these preparatory academies.
Yeah, I think just at social like putting everybody in private school is not social policy. It's abdicating responsibility. That is not the way in which we can actually make our society better. We actually need true investment in not only K through 12 education, public K through 12 education, but in our neighborhoods, because neighborhoods and communities. Because as we know from both rural and urban environments, there are problems and hurdles in those neighborhoods that keep certain students away from college, even if they really want to go. And how do we address those structural problems like joblessness, concentrated poverty, and the like, to make sure that everyone has a chance at achieving the American dream?
Tony, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Anthony Abraham Jack, assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students.